Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, and this is an archive recording from 2020, which was live streamed on my personal YouTube channel during the pandemic. It appeared there because I hadn't got the Beyond channel fully authenticated at the time. We were solely a podcast back in the day, and there was a plague going on and stuff needed doing. As such, whilst the video of an audio feed is still on my personal YouTube channel, it hasn't been here among the rest of the Beyond feed. So, here it is. Home at last. It's a rough live reading of 9 Days Wonder by Will Kemp. And I have left it as I recorded it 4.5 years ago. Warts and all. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast live. I'm your host, Robert Crichton. Don't worry if you've only just got yourself sat down. There's a little bit of intro before we get to Kemp's 9 Days Wonder, which is absolutely fabulous pamphlet. All part of an extended publicity stunt, effectively, by William Kemp, a clown, an actor, a Morris dancer, and everything in between. As much of a celebrity in his own lifetime as anything else. And you're going to hear a whole selection of things that he gets up to further himself, to make his trip from London to Norwich go with a bang, and also the various things that happened or allegedly happened to him. And the fact that he spends a lot of his time in this pamphlet worrying about what other people are saying about him. Let's just say, haters gonna hate. And Will Kemp has to deal with that. If you are listening along live, even if you're not, you can follow the text online. There are various different versions. There's one in the links on the side of the live stream. But also, if you don't want to follow the text, you could also follow on Google Maps, which I only literally a minute ago thought would be a rather good, fun way of doing this, because he does go through various places which are quite close to me. I live in the village of Lavenham. He doesn't go via Lavenham, but he does go very close to me. So I'm hoping that there are some local listeners to this stream who will be sort of fist pump in the air there when their town gets mentioned. Kemp would have been accompanied for his Morris with music, which sadly I don't have any access to doing any music for this live stream. It's just going to be a performance of the text. I've decided on an accent I'm going to go for with Will Kemp. It's almost certainly wrong. I'm going for a sort of London-based sort of accent, but it's all about getting his character across in my performance. I'm not suggesting for a second he would have sounded like this. Accents in history are complicated things, and I'm not actually 100% certain, I'm not even sure historians are 100% certain, where he originally came from or what his accent might have been historically. I've just made a decision which I feel fits the character. He's a lovable comic chancer, and there's a lot of fun to be had from that. Shout out before I get going for Blue Fire Theatre Company. Now, they would have been and possibly still will be touring a show called Kemp's Jig, which is in part based on this pamphlet. It's a proper play that's been touring for about a year now, I think, and they do have dates later in the year. What their situation is in the current plague, I don't know. I was planning to go and see them myself in May, but I don't know whether that's going to happen. If it does, all the best of luck to them for doing something with such a wonderful character. There's so much material here that's fabulous. And if they do find that their tour is curtailed and there's any shout out on the internet, do support them. Do support your local theatres when this plague is over by going and by perhaps donating something to them now. We're all in pretty dire straits in the entertainment business at the moment. We're all very, very unemployed. But then again, I suspect many of my listeners, many of you, are in the same boat. So without further ado, I will move forward. So hopefully you're listening along. The text, I say, is, apart from a few minor editorial changes, pretty accurate. And if the feed does fade in and out, I'm hoping my internet looking quite good at the moment, this is being recorded separately and you will be able to listen again on the podcast where I will post it probably next week. I will stop and start because this is essentially a series of days. It's a 9 days wonder. There's a little introductory dedication and a closing complaint. So in between each of those, I will pause and maybe just elucidate some of the interesting things that come up. There are some wonderful, wonderful details about life at the time that I think is worth a comment. So when I pause, you will hear the sound of... There we are. I did promise bells. Now, I did actually dig out some Morrissey bells, but it sort of just sounds like a sleigh, so I sort of decided not to do that. But I did promise bells, so there were the bells. Without further ado, here is Kemp's 9 Days Wonder, performed in a dance from London to Norwich, containing the pleasure, pains, and kind entertainment of William Kemp between London and that city in his late Morris. Wherein is somewhat set down, worth note, to reprove the slanders spread of him. Many things merry, nothing hurtful. Written by himself to satisfy his friends. To the true ennobled lady and his most bountiful mistress, Mistress Anne Fitton, maid of honour to the most sacred royal Queen Elizabeth. Honourable mistress, in the wane of my little wit, I am forced to desire your protection, else every ballad singer will proclaim me bankrupt of honesty. A sort of mad fellows, seeing me merrily disposed in a Morris, have so bepainted me in print since my gambols began from London to Norwich, that, having but an ill face before, I shall appear to the world without a face, if your fair hand wipe not away their foul colours. One hath written Kemp's Farewell to the tune of Kerry Merry Buff, another his desperate dangers in his late travail, the third his entertainment to Newmarket, which town I came never near in the length of half the heath. Some swear in a Trenchmore I have trod a good way to win the world. Many say many things that were never thought. But in a word, your poor servant offers the truth of his progress and profit to your honourable view. Receive it, I beseech you, such as it is, rude and plain, for I know your pure judgment looks as soon to hear smooth speech from a stammerer as to find anything but blunt mirth in a Morris dancer, especially such a one as Will Kemp, that has spent his life in mad jigs and merry jests. Three reasons move me to make public this journey. One, to reprove lying fools I never knew. The other, to commend loving friends, which, by the way, I daily found. The third, to shew my duty to your honourable self, whose favours, among other bountiful friends, makes me, despite of this sad world, judge my heart cork and my heels feathers, so that methinks I could fly to Rome, at least hop to Rome, as the old proverb is, with a mortar on my head. In which light conceit I lowly beg pardon and leave, for my taborer strikes his hunts up. I must to Norwich. Imagine, noble mistress, I am now setting from my Lord Mayor's. The hour about 7, the morning gloomy, the company many, my heart merry. Your worthy ladyship's most unworthy servant, William Kemp. And his tabourer beating out as he goes. It's a lovely little opening there. Really, how much of that is protesting too much? He's going to protest about a lot of things as he goes, possibly excessively. It's partly style. Some of it, I think, is very, very true. And he's not going alone. And these 9 days are not all sequential days. There are some gaps, shall we say, between where he takes a bit of a rest. But anyway, we will continue with Kemp's 9 Days Wonder, performed in a Morris from London to Norwich, wherein every day's journey is pleasantly set down to satisfy his friends the truth against all lying ballad makers. What he did, how he was welcome, and by whom entertained. The first day's journey, being the first Monday in clean Lent, from the Right Honourable the Lord Mayors of London. The first Monday in Lent, the close morning, promising a clear day, attended on by Thomas Sly, my tabourer, William B., my servant, and George Spratt, appointed for my overseer, that I should take no other ease but my prescribed order, myself, that's I, otherwise called Cavalerio Kemp, headmaster of Morris dancers, high headborough of Hayes, and only tricker of your trill lilies and best bell shangles between Sion and Mount Surrey, began frolically to foot it from the Right Honourable the Lord Mayors of London towards the Right Worshipful and truly bountiful Master Mayors of Norwich. My setting forward was somewhat before 7 in the morning. My tabourer stroke up merrily, and as fast as kind people's thronging together would give me leave, thorough London I leapt. By the way, many good old people, and diverse others of younger years, of mere kindness, gave me bold sixpences and groats, blessing me with their hearty prayers and Godspeed. Being past Whitechapel, and having left fair London with all that north-east suburb before named, multitudes of Londoners left not me, but either to keep a custom, which many hold, that Mile End is no walk without a recreation at Stratford Bow with cream and cakes, or else for love they bear toward me, or perhaps to make themselves merry. If I should chance, as many thought, to give over my Morris within a mile of Mile End. However, many a thousand brought me to Bow, where I rested a while from dancing, but had small rest with those that would have urged me to drinking. But I warrant you, Will Kemp was wise enough. To their full cups, kind thanks was my return with gentlemanlike protestations. As truly, sir, I dare not. It stands not with the congruity of my health. Congruity, said I. How came that strange language in my mouth? I think scarcely that it is any Christian word. And yet it may be a good word, for all I know, though I never made it, nor do very well understand it, yet I am sure I have bought it at the wordmongers at as dear a rate as I could have had a whole 100 of babbins at the woodmongers. Farewell, congruity, for I mean now to be more concise, and stand upon even a basis, but I must neither stand nor sit. The tabourer strikes alarum. Tickle it, good Tom. I'll follow thee. Farewell, Beau. Have over the bridge, where I heard say honest conscience was once drowned. It's pity if it were so, but that's no matter belonging to our Morris. Let's now along to Stratford Langton. Many good fellows, being there met, and knowing how well I love the sport, had prepared a bear baiting. But so unreasonable were the multitudes of people that I could only hear the bear roar and the dogs howl. Therefore, forward I went with my heydegaze to Ilford, where I again rested, and was by the people of the town and country thereabout very, very well welcomed, being offered carouses in the Great Spoon, one whole draught being able at that time to have drawn my little wit dry. But being afraid of the old proverb, he had need of a long spoon that eats with the devil, I soberly gave my boon companions the slip. From Ilford by moonshine, I set forward, dancing within a quarter of a mile of Romford, where in the highway two strong lads, having belike some great quarrel to me unknown, were beating and biting either of other. Oh! And such, through God's help, was my good hap that I escaped their hooves, and both being raised with their forefeet over my head like two smiths over an anvil. There. I'm going to do that bit again. Yes, I apologise. I did misread a letter. Let me try that little bit of journey from Ilford to by moonshine once again. From Ilford by moonshine, I set forward dancing within a quarter of a mile of Romford, where in the highway two strong jades, having belike some great quarrel to me unknown, were beating and biting either of other. And such, through God's help, was my good app that I escaped their hooves, both being raised with their forefeet over my head, like two smiths over an anvil. There being the end of my first day's Morris, a kind gentleman of London, lighting from his horse, would have no nay that I should leap into his saddle. To be plain with you, I was not proud, but kindly took his kindly offer, chiefly thereto urged by my weariness. So I rid to my inn at Romford. In that town, to give rest to my well-laboured limbs, I continued 2 days, being much beholding to the townsmen for their love, but more to the Londoners that came hourly thither in great numbers to visit me, offering much more kindness than I was willing to accept. And thus ends the first day. Apologies there. It doesn't matter how many times I note on the script the correct spelling of jades. Those horses turned into lads very, very quickly. This is life, folks. These things happen. Lots of lovely things there. The constant reference to the size of the crowds. Oh, they followed him out of London. They wouldn't leave him alone. He didn't know, honestly, whether the people following him out to Mile End were going there for him or whether they just fancied some cream and cakes. Oh, who knows? Who knows? And then talking about his own language and the absurdity of someone like him saying congruity. Absolutely wonderful. Wonderful stuff. You will come across a lot of Lord Mayors and notable people of worth who he encounters along his way. And as you know, he's taken his rest. He thought he would keep going further on that first day, but then realised that it was dark, he was knackered, and that maybe riding back the way he came would be a better bet for going forward in the future. The second day's journey, being Thursday of the first week. Thursday being market day at Burntwood, Tom Sly was earlier up than the lark and sounded merrily the Morris. I roused myself and returned from Romford to the place where I took horse the first night, dancing that quarter of a mile back again thorough Romford and so merrily to Burntwood. Yet now I remember it well. I had no great cause of mirth, for at Romford town's end I strained my hip, and for a time endured exceeding pain. But being loath to trouble a surgeon, I held on, finding remedy by labour that had hurt me. For it came in a turn, and so in my dance I turned it out of my service again. The multitudes were so great at my coming to Burntwood that I had much ado, though I made many entreaties and stays, to get passage to my inn. In this town, two cut purses were taken that with other two of their companions followed me from London, as many better disposed persons did. But these two die doppers gave out when they were apprehended that they had laid wagers and betted about my journey. Whereupon the officers, bringing them to my inn, I justly denied their acquaintance, saving that I remembered one of them to be a noted cut purse, such a one as we tie to a post on our stage for all to wonder at when at a play they are taken pilfering. This fellow and his half-brother being found with the deed were sent to jail. Their other two consorts at the charity of the town, and after a dance of Trenchamore at the Whipping Cross, they were sent back to London, where I am afraid there are too many of their occupation. To be short, I thought myself well rid of four such followers, and I wish heartily that the old world were clear of such companions. Having rested well at Birtwood, the moon rise shining clearly and the weather being calm, in the evening I tripped it to Ingerstone, stealing away from those numbers of people that followed me. Yet do what I could, I had above 50 in the company, some of London, the other of the country thereabout, that would needs, when they heard my taper, trudge after me through thick and thin. Yet they won't leave him alone. Those people, they just keep following him. It doesn't matter how many miles he goes. I was going with the original spelling there to strangify Brentwood, and Ingatestone. I think is the two those two names. Again, if you're following on Google Maps, then hopefully you're not completely lost. He does take occasionally some slightly odd routes that I question the logic of doing, but he is, to some degree, going where the best hostelries are, and that may be coming up in some of the tales of his journey to come. But that's day two out of the way. The third day's journey being Friday of the first week. On Friday morning, I set forward towards Chelmsford, not having passed 200, being the least company that I had in the daytime, between London and that place. Onward I went thus, easily followed, till I came to Whitford Bridge, where a number of country people and many gentlemen and gentlewomen were gathered together to see me. Sir Thomas Mildmay, a gentlewoman, Sir Thomas Mildmay, standing at his park pail, received gently a pair of garters of me. Gloves, points and garters being my ordinary merchandise that I put out to venture for performance of my merry voyage. So much ado I had to pass by the people at Chelmsford that it was more than an hour ere I could recover my inn gate, where I was fain to lock myself in my chamber and pacify them with words out of a window instead of deeds. To deal plainly, I was so weary that I could dance no more. The next morning I footed it 3 mile of my way toward Braintree, but returned back again to Chelmsford, where I lay that Saturday and the next Sunday. The good cheer and kind welcome I had at Chelmsford was much more than I was willing to entertain, for my only desire was to refrain drink and be temperate in my diet. At Chelmsford, a maid, not passing 14 years of age, dwelling with one Sudley, my kind friend, made request to her master and dame that she might dance the Morris with me in a large, great room. They being entreated, I was soon won to fit her with bells. Besides, she would have the old fashion with the napkins on her arms, and to our jumps we fell. A whole hour she held out. But then, being ready to lie down, I left her off. But thus much, in her praise, I would have challenged the strongest man in Chelmsford, and amongst many, I think few would have done so much. Thus ends the third day. And there is a continuing theme again of drink. He's very temperate. He's very much about his... One suggests that possibly he had a reputation for drinking that he was trying to undercut. I don't know whether that's true or not. But the challenge of the maid is something that will come up, as there's a lot of enterprising dancers out there. And certainly he may have been over-enthusiastic with some of his Morris in those first few days, because he's clearly feeling the pain of it. And maybe at this almost midway point, he's starting to regret things. But that was the end of the third day. The fourth day's journey being Monday of the second week. On Monday morning very early, I rid the 3 miles that I danced the Saturday before, where alighting, my taborer struck up, and lightly I tripped forward. But I had the heaviest way that ever mad Morris dancer trod. Yet, with hay and hoe through thick and thin, the hobby horse quite forgotten, I followed as I did begin, although the way were rotten. This foul way I could find no ease in, thick woods being on either side the lane likewise being full of deep holes. Sometimes I skipped up to the waist. But it is an old proverb that it is a little comfort to the miserable to have companions. Amidst this miry way, I had some mirth by an unlooked-for accident. It was the custom of honest country fellows, my unknown friends, upon hearing of my pipe, which might well be heard in a still morning or evening a mile, to get up and bear me company a little way. In this foul way, 2 pretty plain youths watched me, and with their kindness somewhat hindered me. One, a fine light fellow, would be still before me, the other ever at my heels. At length, coming to a broad plash of water and mud, which could not be avoided, I fetched a rise, yet fellow in over the ankles at the further end. My youth that followed me took his jump and stuck fast in the midst, crying out to his companion, "Come, George, call ye this dancing, I'll go no further." For indeed he could go no further till his fellow was fain to wade and help him out. I could not choose but laugh to see how like 2 frogs they laboured. Oh, a hearty farewell I gave them. And they faintly bade God speed me, saying, if I danced that dirty way this 7 years again, they would never dance after me. Well, with much ado, I got into Braintree by noon, tarried there Monday night and the next day. Only I danced 3 miles on Tuesday to ease my Wednesday's journey. If I should deny that I was welcome at Braintree, I should slander an honest, kind crew of kind men, among whom I fared well, slept well, and was every way well used. So merry instant along the way, where 2 of his friendly helpers and hinderers got themselves massively covered in mud. And again, there's the sense of, as part of this journey, he's thanking and praising the people he's passed. So all of the towns he's going through, he's saying nice things about them, how friendly they are. Because, of course, if he wants to spread his reputation then far and wide throughout the country, then this is part of that effort. Of course, it could also just be true. So, having eased his way on this journey, he's preparing for a longer Morris on the fifth day. The fifth day's journey being Wednesday of the second week. Taking advantage of my 3 miles that I danced the day before, this Wednesday morning I tripped it to Sudbury, Whether came to see a very kind gentleman, Master Foscue, that had before travailed afoot from London to Berwick, who, giving me good counsel to observe temperate diet for my health and other advice to be careful of my company, besides his liberal entertainment, departed, leaving me much indebted to his love. In this town of Sudbury, there came a lusty tall fellow, a butcher by his profession, that would in a Morris keep me company to Berry. I, being glad of his friendly offer, gave him thanks, and forward did we set. But ere we had measured half a mile of our way, he gave me over in the plain field, protesting that he might get £100 he would not hold out with me. For indeed, my pace in dancing is not ordinary. As he and I were parting, a lusty country lass, being among the people, called him faint-hearted lout, saying, if I had begun to dance, I would have held out 1 mile, though it had cost my life. At which words many laughed. Nay, saith she, if the dancer will lend me a lease of his bells, I'll venture to tread 1 mile with him myself. I looked upon her, saw mirth in her eyes, heard boldness in her words, and beheld her ready to tuck up her russet petticoat. I fitted her with bells, which she, merrily taking, garnished her thick short legs, and with a smooth brow bade the tabor begin. The drum struck. Forward marched I with my merry maid Marian, who shook her fat sides and footed it merrily to Melford, being a long mile. There, parting with her, I gave her, besides her skinful of drink, an English crown to buy more drink. For good wench, she was in a piteous heat. My kindness she requited with dropping some dozen of short curtsies and bidding God bless the dancer. I bade her adieu, and to give her her due, she had a good ear, danced truly, and we parted friendly. But ere I part with her, a good fellow, my friend, having writ an odd rhyme of her, I will make bold to set it down. So I'm going to pause midway through this particular fifth day. So this is where a fan has produced some fan art for him, which is to mark the occasion that has just occurred of this merry local lass dancing a mile with Kemp, and Kemp allegedly regurgitates it for us now, whether it's written by this fan really or whether it's by Kemp himself, we shall see. A country lass, brown as a berry, blithe of blee and heart as merry, cheeks well fed and sides well larded, every bone with fat flesh guarded, meeting merry Kemp by chance, was Marian in his Morris dance. Her stump legs with bells were garnished, her brown brows with sweating varnished, her brown hips, when she was lagged to win the ground, went swigger swag, which to see all that came after were replete with mirthful laughter. Yet she thumped it on her way with a sportly hey de gay. At a mile her dance she ended, kindly paid and well commended. At Melford, diverse gentlemen met me, who brought me to one Master Colts, a very kind and worshipful gentleman, where I had unexpected entertainment till the Saturday. From whose house, having hoped somewhat to amend my way to Berry, I determined to go by Clare, but I found it to be both farther and fouler. And thus ends day 5, and he determines to go by Clare, which, to my mind, from Long Melford, seems a slightly odd route to get to Bury St Edmunds. Not completely illogical, but it doesn't quite make sense, but it seems to be about who he's going to meet. Do you think Kemp wrote that himself, or was it written by a fan? Who can tell? Anyway, that was day 5. The sixth day's journey being Saturday of the second week. From Wednesday night till Saturday, having been very troublesome but much more welcome to Master Colts, in the morning I took my leave and was accompanied with many gentlemen a mile of my way. Which mile, Master Colts is full, would needs dance with me and add his desire, where leaving me, two fools parted fair in a foul way. I, keeping on my course to Clare, where I a while rested, and then cheerfully set forward to Bury. Passing from Clare towards Bury, I was invited to the house of a very bountiful widow, whose husband during his life was a yeoman of that country, dying rich, no doubt, as might well appear by the riches and plenty that abounded in every corner of the house. She is called the Widow Everett. At her house were met above 30 gentlemen. Such and so plentiful variety of good fare I have very seldom seen in any commoner's house. Her behaviour being very modest and friendly, arguing her bringing up not to be rude. She was a woman of good presence, and if a fool may judge, of no small discretion. From this widow's I danced to Bury, coming in on the Saturday in the afternoon, at what time the Right Honourable the Lord Chief Justice entered at an other gate of the town, the wondering and regardless multitude making his honour clear way, left the streets where he passed to gape at me. The throng of them being so great that poor Will Kemp was seven times stayed ere he could recover his inn. By reason of the great snow that then fell, I stayed at Bury from Saturday in the second week of my setting forth till Thursday night the week following. So, yes, he makes use to some degree of this crowd and this way in the throng. And who's going? Who in that throng was going to see whom coming through? So there's some interesting ones there. And then this mention of the Widow Everett and the fact that he talks about her in such glowing terms. Again, did she not only give him a room and food, but did she also offer him money? And is that her mention here part of that exchange? It reminds me very much today of people. Doing Patreon and doing services for people online, though that isn't possibly a perfect analogue. That was day six. The seventh day's journey being Friday of the third week. Upon Friday morning, I set onwards towards Thetford, dancing that 10 mile in 3 hours. For I left Bury somewhat after 7 in the morning and was at Thetford somewhat after 10 that same forenoon. But indeed, considering how I had been booted the other journeys before, and that all this way, or the most of it, was over a heath, it was no great wonder. For I fared like one that had escaped the stocks and tried the use of his legs to outrun the constable. So light was my heels that I counted the 10 mile no better than a leap. At my entrance into Thetford, the people came in great numbers to see me, for there were many there, being size time. The noble gentleman Sir Edwin Rich gave me entertainment in such bountiful and liberal sort during my continuance there Saturday and Sunday that I want fit words to express the least part of his worthy visage of my unworthiness, and to conclude liberally as he had begun and continued at my departure on Monday, his worship gave me £5. So on day seven, he's not only talking about people who've helped him, but he's also stating the donation to the cause of him. And of course, there's lots of people there in Thetford at the time because there's the assizes, there's various court proceedings going on, there's various activities which are bringing people in there. So he's making use of that. Regardless of the previous snowy conditions, people are making it across the country. That was day seven. The eighth day's journey being Monday of the fourth week. On Monday morning I durst to Rockland ere I rested, and coming to my inn, where the host was a very boon companion, I desired to see him, but in no case he would be spoken with till he had shifted himself from his working day's suit. Being armed at all points, from the cap to the codpiece, his black shoes shining and made straight with copper buckles of its best, his garters in the fashion and every garment fitting corem sequendum, to use his own word, he enters the hall. With his bonnet in his hand, began to cry out, "Oh, Kemp, dear Master Kemp, you are even as, and so," stammering, he began to study for a fit comparison. "And I thank him at last he fitted me, for," saith he, "thou art even as welcome as the Queen's best greyhound." After this dogged yet well-meaning salutation, the carousers were called in, and my friendly host of Rockland began with all this, blessing the hour upon his knees that any of the Queen's Majesty's well-willers or friends would vouchsafe to come within his house, as if never any such had been within his doors before. I took his good meaning and gave him great thanks for his kindness, and having rested me well, began to take my course for Hingham, whether my honest host of Rockland would needs be my guide, but good true fat belly, he had not followed me 2 fields, but he lies all along, and cries after me to come back and speak with him. I fulfilled his request, and coming to him, "Dancer," quoth he, "if thou dance, a God's name, God speed thee. I cannot follow thee afoot, father, but adieu, good dancer. God speed thee if thou dance, a God's name." I having haste of my way, and he being able to keep no way, there we parted. Farewell, he was a kind, good fellow, a true Trojan, and a true Trojan, and it ever be my luck to meet him at more leisure, I'll make him full amends with a cup full of canary. But now I am a little better advised, we must not lest my mad host pass, for my friend late mentioned before that made the odd rhyme on my maid Marian would needs remember my host, such as it is. I'll bluntly sit it down. He was a man not over spare. In his eyeballs dwelt no care. Anon, anon, and welcome, friend, were the most words he used to spend. Save sometime he would sit and tell what wonders once in Bullain fell, closing each period of his tale with a full cup of nut-brown ale. Turwin and Turney's siege were hot, yet all my host remembers not. Ketfield and Musselburgh fray were battles fought but yesterday. Oh, 'twas a good matter then to see your sword and buckler men. They would lie here and here and there, but I would meet them everywhere. And now a man is but a pickle. But now a man is but a pick. A boy armed with a poting stick will dare to challenge Cutting Dick. Oh, 'tis a world, the world to see, but 'twill not mend for thee or nor me. By this some guest cries, "Ho, the house! A fresh friend hath a fresh carouse. Still he will drink and still be dry, and quaff with every company. Saint Martin, send him merry mates to enter at his hostry gates. For a blither lad than he cannot an innkeeper be." Well, once again, farewell mine host at Rockland. After all these farewells, I am sure, to Hingham I found a foul way, as I had done from Thetford to Rockland. Yet, besides the deep way, I was much hindered by the desire people had to see me. For even as our shopkeepers will hail and pull a man with "Lack ye," and "What do you lack, gentlemen?" my ware is best cries one. "Mine best in England," says another. "Here shall you have choose," saith the third. So I was So was the diverse forces of the young men and maidens which I should meet at every mile's end, thronging by 20 and sometimes 40, a hundredths in a company. One crying, the farthest way was thorough there, village. Another, this is the nearest and fairest way, when you have passed but a mile and a half. And another sort cry, turn on the left hand, some on the right hand. I was so amazed, I knew not sometime which way I might best take. Haphazard, the people still accompanying me, with a wit that I was much comforted, though the ways were bad. But, as I said before, at last I overtook it. So yes, the people once again being hinderers rather than helpers, constantly calling alternative directions. And it's not like there are the kind of maps we have today. He doesn't necessarily know what is the best route or how good the signposts are. He is in part dependent on people telling him how to get to places. And once again, we have this alleged pen portrait of someone that he encountered along the way, which has been reiterated there. Whether we believe it is true or not, again, is entirely up to you. And now, the final day. The 9 days' journey being Wednesday of the fourth week. The next morning I left Ingham, not staying till I came to Barford Bridge, 5 young men running all the way with me, for otherwise my pace was not for footmen. From Barford Bridge I danced to Norwich, but coming within the sight of the city, perceiving so great a multitude and throng of people still crowding more and more about me, mistrusting it would be a let to my determined expedition and pleasurable humour, which I long before conceived to delight this city with, so far as my best skill and industry of my long-travelled sinews could afford them, I was advised, and so took ease by that advice, to stay my Morris a little above St. Giles' gate, his gate, where I took my gelding and so rid into the city, procrastinating my merry Morris dance through the city till better opportunity. Being come into the city, Master Roger Willer the Mayor and sundry other of his worshipful brethren sent for me, who, perceiving how I intended not to dance into the city that night, and being well satisfied with the reasons, they allotted me time enough not to dance in till Saturday after, to the end that divers knights and gentlemen, together with their wives and children, who had been many days before deceived with expectation of my coming, might now have sufficient warning accordingly by Saturday following. In the mean space, and during my still continuance in the city afterwards, they not only very courteously offered to bear mine own charges and my followers, but very bountifully performed it at the common charges. The mayor and many of the aldermen oftentimes besides invited us privately to their several houses. To make a short end of this tedious description of my entertainment, Saturday no sooner came, but I returned without the city through St. Giles' his gate, and began my Morris where I left at that gate, but I entered in at St. Stephen's gate, where one Thomas Gilbert, in name of all the rest of the citizens, gave me a friendly and exceeding kind welcome, which I have no reason to omit, unless I would condemn myself of ingratitude, partly for the private affection of the writer towards me, as also for the general love and favour I found in them, from the highest to the lowest, the richest as the poorest. It follows in these few lines. Master Kemp, his welcome to Norwich. With heart and hand, among the rest, especially you welcome are. Long looked for as welcome guest, come now at last, you be from far. Of many within the city shore, many good wishes you have had. Each one did pray you might endure, with courage good the match you made. Intend they did with gladsome hearts, like your well-willers you to meet. Know you also they'll do their parts, either in field or house to greet, more you than any with you came. procured thereto with trump and fame. Your well-willer, T.G. Passing the gate, whifflers, such officers as were appointed by the mayor to make me way through the throng of the people, which pressed so mightily upon me, with great labour I got thorough the narrow peas into the open marketplace, where on the cross, ready prepared, stood the city waits, which not a little refreshed my weariness with toiling thorough so narrow a lane as the people left me. Such waits, under Benedetti it be it spoken, few cities in our realm have the like. None better. Who, besides their excellency in wind instruments, their rare cunning on the viol and violin, their voices be admirable, every one of them, able to serve in any cathedral church in Christendom for quiet choristers. Passing by the marketplace, the press still increasing by the number of boys and girls, men and women thronging more and more before me to see the end. Oh, here was the mischance of a homely maid that belike was never but newly crept into the fashion of long-waisted petticoats tied with points, and had, as it seemed, but one point tied before, and coming unluckily in my way as I was fetching a leap, it fell out that I set my foot on her skirts. The point either breaking or stretching off fell her petticoat from her waist. But as chance was, though her smock were coarse, it was cleanly. Yet the poor wench was so ashamed, the rather that she could hardly recover her coat again from unruly boys that looked before like one that had the green sickness. Now she had her cheeks all coloured with scarlet. I was sorry for her. But on I went towards the mayor's, and deceived the people by leaping over the churchyard wall at St. John's, getting so into Master Mayor's gates a nearer way. But at last I found it the further way about, being forced on the Tuesday following to renew my former dance, because George Spratt, my overseer, having lost me in the throng, could not be disposed that I had danced it, since he saw me not. And I must confess, I did not well, for the citizens had caused all the turnpikes to be taken up on Saturday, that I might not be hindered. Anyway, but now I return again to my lump, the measure of which is to be seen in the Guildhall at Norwich, where my buskins, that I then wore and danced in from London thither, stand equally divided, nailed on the wall. The plenty of good cheer at the mayor's, his bounty and kind usage, together with the general welcomes of his worshipful brethren and many other knights, ladies, gentlemen and gentlewomen, so much exceeded my expectation as I judged myself most bound to them all. The mayor gave me £5 in Elizabeth Angels, which mayor, fair madam, to whom I too presumptuously dedicate my idle paces, as a man worthy of a singular and impartial admiration, if our critic humorous minds could as prodigally conceive as he deserves for his chaste life, liberality and temperance in possessing worldly benefits. He lives unmarried and childless, never purchased house nor land. The house he dwells in this year being but hired, oh, he lives upon merchandise, being a merchant venturer. If our merchants and gentlemen would take example by this man, a gentleman would not sell their lands to become bankrupt merchants, nor merchants live in the possessions of youth beguiled gentlemen who cast themselves out of their parents' heritages for a few outcast commodities. But whither wilt thou? What hath Morris Tripping Will to do with that? Oh, it keeps not time. That is dance. Therefore, room you moral precepts, give my legs leave to end my Morris, or, that being ended, my hands leave to perfect this worthless, poor, tottered volume. Pardon me, madam, that I am thus tedious. I cannot choose but commend sacred liberality, which makes poor wretches partakers of all comfortable benefits, besides the love and favour already repeated. Master Wheel, the mayor, gave me 40 shillings yearly during my life, making me a free man of the merchant venturers. This is the substance of all my journey. Therefore, let no man believe, however before, by lying ballads and rumours, they have been abused, that either ways were laid open for me, or that I delivered gifts to Her Majesty. It's good being merry, my masters, but in a mean, and all my mirths, mean though they be, have been and ever shall be employed to the delight of my royal mistress, whose sacred name ought not to be remembered among such ribald rhymes as these late thin-reached lying ballad singers have proclaimed it. It resteth now that, in a word, I show what profit I have made by my Morris. True, it is, I put out some money to have threefold gain at my return. Some that love me, regard my pains, and respect their promise, have sent home the treble worth. Some other, at the first sight, have paid me, if I came to seek them. Others I cannot see, nor will they willingly be found, and these are the greater number. If they had all used me well or all ill, I would have bodily set down the true sum of my small gain or loss. But I will have patience some few days longer. At the end of which time, if any be behind, I will draw a catalogue of all their names I ventured with. Those that have shown themselves honest men, I will set before them this character H for honesty. If all the other bench whistlers shall stand K for kettlers and kestrels, that will drive a good companion without need in them to contend for his own. But I hope I shall have no such need. If I have, your honourable protection shall thus far defend your poor servant, that he may, being a plain man, call a spade a spade. Thus, fearing your ladyship is wearier with reading this toy than I was in all my merry travel, I crave pardon, and conclude this first pamphlet that ever Will Kemp offered to the press, being thereunto pressed on the one side by the pitiful papers pasted on every post of that which was neither so nor so, and on the other side urged thereto in duty to express with thankfulness the kind entertainment I found. Your Honour's poor servant, W.K. And that is almost the end. It's not quite the end, because Kemp hasn't quite finished trying to get at the haters. That last sequence was very much all about he didn't really make any actual money. People gave him money, but the expenses and the money he put out before he went, and some people haven't paid him, and so he's sort of trying to proclaim that people who've been saying things about him and these money making of that he may have made in this trip, that it's not true and it's not fair. A couple of lovely things that came up in there. You may have wondered what a whiffler is. That's basically crowd control. A whiffler moves people back. Sometimes they're actually armed with a sort of giant sparklers. It's been known for them to have basically just a spray people to get them out of the way with burning ordnance, which is always fun. The waits, the city waits, will be musicians paid for by the city or town, depending on their circumstances. Norwich, they are obviously very, very good. But you get accounts of waits all across the country, as music's very, very important to people, not just for occasions, but also civil and religious, of course. But the final sequence follows on very much from where we left off, where he's trying to right a few wrongs that he feels have been done against him. This is quite a tricksy little sequence, but we are now pretty much at the end. Kemp's humble request to the impudent generation of ballad makers and their coherents, that it would please their rascalities to pity his pains in the great journey he pretends, and not fill the country with lies of his never-done acts as they did in his late Morris to Norwich. To the tune of Thomas Deloney's epitaph. My notable shake rags, the effect of my suit is discovered in the title of my supplication. But for your better understandings, for that I know you to be a sort of witless beetleheads that can understand nothing but what is knocked into your scalps, these are by these presents to certify unto your blockheadships that I, William Kemp, whom you had ne'er rent in sunder with your unreasonable rhymes, am shortly, God willing, to set forward as merrily as I may, whether I wish ye employ not your wits in certifying the world that I am gone to Rome, Jerusalem, Venice, or any other place in your idler point. I know the best of ye by the lies ye writ of me. Got not the price of a good hat to cover your brainless heads. If any of ye had come to me, my bounty should have exceeded the best of your good masters, the ballad buyers. I would have apparelled your dry pates in party-coloured bonnets and bestowed a lease of my cast bells to have crowned ye with coxcombs. I have made a privy search what private lingmonger of your jolly number hath been the author of these abominable ballads written of me. I was told it was the great ballad maker T.D., alias Thomas Delaunay, chronicler of the memorable lives of the six yeomen of the West, Lack of Newbury, the gentle craft, and such like honest men, omitted by Stowe, Hollingshed, Grafton Hall, and the rest of those well-deserving writers. But I was given since to understand your late General Thomas died poorly, as ye all must do, and was honestly buried, which is much to be doubted of some of you. The quest of inquiry, finding him by death acquitted of the indictment, I was led to wit that another lord of little wit, one whose employment for the pageant was utterly spent, he being known to be Elderton's immediate heir, was vehemently suspected. But after due inquisition was made, he was at that time known to live like a man in the midst of quite given over the mystery. Still the search continuing, I met a proper upright youth, only for a little stooping in the shoulders, all heart to the heel, a penny poet, whose first making was the miserable stone story of MacDole or MacDebeth or Mac somewhat, for I'm sure it was a Mac. For I'm sure a Mac it was. And though I never had the more to see it. And he told me there was a fat, filthy ballad maker that should have once been his journeyman to the trade, who lived about the town, and 10 to 1, but he had thus terribly abused me and my tabourer, for that he was able to do such a thing in print. A shrewd presumption. I found him about the bankside, sitting at a play. I desired to speak with him. Had him to a tavern, charged a pipe with tobacco, and then laid this terrible accusation to his charge. He swells presently like one of the four winds. The violence of his breath blew the tobacco out of the pipe, and the heat of his wrath drunk dry 2 bowlfuls of Rhinish wine. At length, having power to speak, name my accuser, saith he, or I defy thee, Kemp, at the court staff. I told him, and all his anger turned to laughter. Swearing it did him good to have ill words of a hoddy doddy, a habberdy hoy, a chicken, a squib, a squall, one that hath not wit enough to make a ballad, that by pole and adipole would poll his father, Derek his dad, do anything, howsoever it please, his apish humour. I hardly believe this youth that I took to be gracious had been so graceless. But I heard afterwards his mother-in-law was eye and ear witness of his father's abuse by this blessed child on a public stage and in a merry host of an inn's part. Yet all this while could not I find out the true ballad-maker. By this, till by chance, a friend of mine pulled out of his pocket a book in Latin called Mundus Furiosus, printed at Cullen, written by one of the vilest and arrantest lying cullions that ever writ book. His name, Jansonius, who, taking upon him to write an abstract of all the turbulent actions that had been lately attempted or performed in Christendom, like some unchristian wretch, writes only by report, partially and scoffingly, of such whose pages' shoes he was unworthy to wipe. For indeed, he is now dead. Farewell, he. Every dog must have a day. But see the luck on't. This beggarly, lying, busybody's name brought out the ballad maker, and it was generally confirmed it was his kinsman. He confesses himself guilty, let any man look on his face. If there be not so red a colour that all the sop in the town will not wash white, let me be turned to a whiting as I pass between Dover and Calais. Well, God forgive thee, honest fellow, I see thou hast grace in thee. I prithee do so no more, leave writing these beastly ballads. Make not good wenches prophetesses for little or no profit, nor for a sixpenny matter. Revive not a poor fellow's fault that's hanged for his offence. It may be thine own destiny one day, prithee. Be good to them. Call up thine old Melpomene, whose strawberry quill may write the bloody lines of the Blue Lady and the Prince of the Burning Crown. A better subject, I can tell ye, than your Knight of the Red Cross. So, farewell. Cross me no more, I prithee, with thy rabble of bald rhymes, lest at my return I set a cross on thy forehead, that all men may know thee for a fool. William Kemp. And that ends Kemp's 9 Days Wonder. I had to do something vaguely clownish, even if that was just silly. I apologise. So yes, something of a rambling tale full of what feels like lots of theatre gossip and crossovers and jokes and callbacks and getting at people that need a bit of time to unpack. So if you got a little lost in there, that's fine. You get the energy of it all, of is this hunt for the ballad writer who wrote terrible things about him, and the futility of that journey. So that's a lovely little portrait into the world of a jobbing actor, clown, performer in the turn of the 16th into the 17th century. And that's it for this live stream. This will be backed up so that you can all listen to my trips and stumbles at your leisure. And one day there might be a more proper and considered recording of this coming to the podcast in the future. Thank you very much for listening. If you have been listening, if you haven't been listening, then that's a shame. You're not hearing any of this. I hope I'll see you on Twitter at Beyond Shakes or on any of our outlets. We are the Beyond Shakespeare Podcast Live. The Beyond Shakespeare Podcast can be found on wherever your podcasts live.